As I remarked earlier, Dr. Tenbrook imagined that the law applied to people who have disabilities, and he wrote about that. So we named this symposium after him. And part of the process in having disability law become a part of the land is to get the attention of people in positions where decisions are made that matter with respect to the law. We have a person who has been sworn in as the Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division at the United States Department of Justice. He, before this particular time in the Department of Justice, served as the Secretary of Maryland's Department of Labor, Licensing, and Regulation. He was a member of the Montgomery County Council and served for a time as the president of that council. Earlier, he spent 12 years in federal public service, most of the time in the Department of Justice, in the Civil Rights Division. Part of his tenure in the Department of Justice was as an assistant attorney general for civil rights under Attorney General Janet Reno. He has been special counsel to the late Senator Edward Kennedy, and he was Senator Kennedy's advisor on civil rights, criminal justice, and constitutional issues. He served as the director of the Office for Civil Rights at the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And he has spent a number of years as a professor of law. I have been to the Department of Justice more than once. I have represented blind people in efforts to get attention by the Department of Justice. In the recent time, the welcome has been warm. The recognition of the needs of individuals with disabilities has been easier to have understood. The understanding of the kinds of work that we are trying to do has had depth which sometimes I have not found. With all of this in mind, I ask you to welcome Assistant Attorney General Thomas Perez.
Mark, thank you for that kind introduction. I've always had profound respect for you, and my respect got even greater when we were chatting at lunch, and I asked you what was the budget when you first got here to NFB, and you said $2 million, and what is the budget now? And you told me $22 million. I know a governor who might be interested in your services on the side during an election year. Sorry, your old loyalties die hard working for this Governor O'Malley. It's great to be here. I mean, there's so many old friends in this room. I feel like I'm among, if I looked in the dictionary under serial activists, I would see many photographs. One of my former students, one of my best students I ever had, I see Rachel London in the back, who has dedicated her career to civil rights and disability rights in particular. The wonderful law firm of Brown, Goldstein, and Levy, who've done so much for people with disabilities. And I see Dan and Joe and the whole gang, and it's great to see them on a national level. My good friend Andy Imperato, who has done so much for people with disabilities across this country. And so, Andy, welcome to Maryland, and thank you for coming up here. And I want to introduce two of my colleagues at the Department of Justice. Sam Bagenstos is our principal deputy, and you really ought to be clapping for this guy, because, and Mazen Bazrawi is to Sam's left. Mazen is one of my counsels as well. If you can just raise your hand, Mazen, they'll know where you are. I'm a big believer in the following philosophy. It's worked well for me. I like to hire people who are far smart. Mark Sharmat, my God, you look out in the audience. You know, periodically, you just look around and you see an old friend. Mark and I taught in the clinics together at Maryland Law School. Mark, welcome and thank you for your constant mentoring of law students and tomorrow's activists. I didn't see you there. I'm a big believer in the notion that the best way to get things done is to hire the right people. And and this is not hard to accomplish. I'm a bigger believer in hiring people who are far smarter than me. And Sam and Mazen have done, they've really spearheaded our disability rights and disability empowerment agenda. And we've done a lot that we're very, very proud of, but we've got a lot more to do. So I am very blessed to have as our principal deputy AAG, Sam Bagenstos, and Mazen Bazrawi doing so much work. So again, thanks for having me here. And I love it. I love the fact that you call this the Tenbroek Symposium, and we're in the Jernigan Building, because those are truly two heavyweights in the civil rights movement. They were not simply, in my judgment, leaders of people who were blind. They were civil rights leaders. They may have had a vision impairment, but they certainly had a clear vision, in my mind, about empowering people with disabilities. They were civil rights leaders because their dedication to the rights of individuals who are blind had a profound impact not only on the way those individuals perceive themselves or the way those of us who are not blind perceive them. Their work also helped us change the way we all perceive ourselves and our abilities and how we think about disability. I always think about the ability side of disabilities, thanks to people like them, and thanks to people like you. Professor Tenbroek wrote extensively about the fundamental right of people with disabilities to live in the world. In one of his most memorable speeches, Dr. Jernigan talked about blindness being a characteristic and not a quote-unquote handicap, which was a revolutionary concept, as you know, at the time. When I used to teach a civil rights clinic at Maryland Law School, and the first thing I used to do day one frequently was I would write the following word on the board. I would write the word discrimination, and I would have this Pavlovian exercise. I would ask my students to tell me, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? And it would always be, it would invariably be Dr. King, Brown versus Board, racial profiling, the glass ceiling, understandable things of that nature. And indeed, in the Civil Rights Division, we spend a lot of time and will continue appropriately to spend a lot of time ensuring that the legacy of racial discrimination, that the hard work that so many of Dr. King's disciples and so many people across this country, whether it was Selma, Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, or Greensboro, North Carolina, we will always honor their memory through the effective enforcement of civil rights that empowers people. But we must also recognize that civil rights is a very, very broad concept, and that is what we are all about in the Civil Rights Division, because there were so many other people who are perhaps less known, so many other causes that were less known, groups that had to claw their way from under the weight of immoral laws and misguided social mores. Women spending decades fighting for the right to vote, facing ridicule, and sometimes imprisonment before we saw the 19th Amendment passed in 1920. Today, we fight hard for the rights of our LGBT brothers and sisters, recognizing that they must have equal opportunity to succeed. So many challenges, and I was so proud of the hate crimes bill that the president signed last fall. And that was such a mantle of progress. And people like Andy were part of that movement because he recognizes that we are all in this together. Civil rights is indeed about coalition building. And I remember when I went to the Department of Health and Human Services, you'd see the bust of Hubert Humphrey, who said, and this saying was right next to his bust, "The moral test of our strength as a nation is how we treat those in the dawn of life, our children, how we treat those in the twilight of life, the elderly, and how we treat those in the shadows of life." And my friends, too many people with disabilities are living in the shadows of life. And I am here to tell you that the Civil Rights Division is open for business, and we will work side by side with you and others to ensure that individuals with disabilities are empowered in a broad array of ways, shapes, and forms, so that the promise of equal opportunity for everyone can be a promise that is realized in your community, in our communities. As you know, we're about to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the ADA. What an absolutely remarkable accomplishment. And when I might not have accepted this invitation had I known that your morning speaker was going to be Tony Coelho, because that is really not fair. It's impossible to follow a speaker of his magnitude. And Tony and so many others, including my former boss, Senator Kennedy, ushered in the passage of the ADA, which literally opened up millions of doors for people with disabilities. As the head of the Civil Rights Division, I have the honor of leading the effort to ensure that the ADA is given meaning. It really has, as we reflect on 20 years of the ADA, it has revolutionized the way that society thinks about people with disabilities, and it has revolutionized the way that people with disabilities live in our community. We have undeniably made remarkable progress thanks to serial activists like you in this room and across the nation. But we must also be honest with ourselves. While we have indeed made a lot of progress, we indeed have a lot of unfinished business. As my former boss, Senator Kennedy, used to say with regularity, civil rights remains the unfinished business of America, and disability rights remains a big part of that unfinished business of civil rights, because we still see every single day barriers old and new confronting people with disabilities, and we must, again, address those barriers. And that is why the Civil Rights Division is indeed open for business. That is why we are feverishly working on the new ADA regulations and expect to have them ready for publication in the very near future. We also recognize that modern technologies, and we were talking about this at lunchtime, how years ago, very recently, it was very difficult for people who are blind to read a newspaper. But as a result of your advocacy here and the work you've done, we've been able to use technology as an ally so that people can now have access to those critical media. And we recognize, though, that modern technologies can continue to pose significant challenge, and we must remain vigilant to ensure that these new technologies are our friend and they don't leave us behind. And that's why I want to say thank you to Dan Goldstein for his work bringing the issue of the Kindle to our attention. And I'm very proud of the work that we did reaching agreements with 5 universities. Princeton, is Princeton accredited? I'm sorry. The University of Arizona, Pace, Case Western, I'm sorry, I couldn't resist that, and Reed College. Those institutions have agreed not to use inaccessible electronic readers, and we will continue to make sure that other institutions follow suit. And we continue to work with our friends at the Department of Education on guidance so that we can take these cases and use them to spread the word to general counsels across this nation so that those can be the example that other facilities and universities can follow. But many of the technologies, from websites to cell phones to ticket kiosks to TV set-top devices, are either in whole or in part not accessible to people who are blind or other people with disabilities. And though we have seen some voluntary efforts at compliance by a number of companies, far too many companies have chosen to forego what I believe will prove to be a very profitable venture. This is about telling someone that you can do good and do well at the same time. That's really the message about technology and people with disabilities, and that's the message that we are seeking to impart. And so I want to thank Dan and again and others for bringing these matters to our attention, and NFB for your continued vigilance in this area. And let me also reiterate something. It's something that was reiterated first, I believe, around 1996. It has been the position of the Department of Justice since at least that time, 1996, that Title III of the ADA applies to websites. And so we intend to issue regulations under our Title III authority in this regard to help companies comply with their obligations to provide equal access. We've got a lot of regulatory work. Once again, I believe that market forces will assist the legal forces at work here, because companies that do not consider accessibility in their website or their product development are going to regret that decision, because they will be left behind, in my judgment, and we will use every legal tool in our disposal to ensure that there is equal access to these technologies. Now, I don't simply want to focus on the issue of technologies, because we have a wide array of things going on in the Civil Rights Division to empower individuals with disabilities. Under Sam's leadership, we have been working feverishly to address the illegal but all too common practice of segregating people with disabilities in institutions. Sam and I traveled recently to Georgia to meet with the governor to talk about the Olmstead case, because as you know, in 1999, the Supreme Court ruled that the unnecessary institutionalization of people with disabilities is a form of discrimination under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And yet, 10 years later, we did not see sufficient progress, and that is why we traveled down to Georgia. That is why we will continue to travel to every other state that we need to travel to. That's why we filed a lawsuit against Arkansas. That's why we filed an amicus brief up in Connecticut. That's why we're involved in New York State. And we will be involved in every state that is necessary to ensure that people with disabilities who want to live in community-based settings will be able to do that. Because Dr. Tenbroek, in his article, The Right to Live in the World, he asked the following question. Are persons, after all, not to be persons if they are physically disabled? Are members of the community to be robbed of their rights to live in the community, their certificates canceled upon development or discovery of disability? Well, as long as we're here, I can assure you that we will work our level best to ensure that we give meaning to the Olmstead decision. And that is why you know, the old paradigm in facilities used to be, is the facility safe? And that's a critically important question to ask. But under Sam's leadership, we are now asking two questions when we look at facilities. Question number one, are there people in this facility who shouldn't be in this facility and who could live in community-based settings with the proper supports? That's question number one. And question number two is, of the people who can we make those facilities safe, and what can we do? Those are two questions that we will always ask. It's a two-step, it's not a one-step, and that is what we will do as we seek to enforce the ADA in this context. We're also working to combat discrimination by public entities in the zoning context. We have a lawsuit pending here in the city of Baltimore. One of the finest lawyers in the city of Baltimore is in this room, and I'm confident that we'll continue to work together with Suzanne and George Nilsson, the city solicitor. But regrettably, we've had cases across the country involving zoning decisions that we believe have a discriminatory impact on the ability to establish community-based residency for people with disabilities. We're also working on Project Civic Access, 176 agreements under the program to date, dealing with all aspects of civic life, including courthouses, health departments, libraries, parks, theaters, stadiums, sidewalks, emergency shelters, as well as employment, voting, emergency preparedness, and effective communications, especially in law enforcement and 911 services. I was in Birmingham, Alabama last week, and I met with the disability rights activists there, and one of the people told me the story of his efforts to go into City Hall in Montgomery, Alabama, to file a complaint, and he was told to leave because he was in a wheelchair and the building wasn't accessible. Remarkable. By the way, Sam, memo to file, we got a little work to do in Montgomery, Alabama. We recently settled a case in the transportation context in Jackson, Mississippi, relating to the failure to provide public transit system that is accessible and to make their paratransit systems fully compliant with their obligations under the ADA. The consent decree with Jackson mandates not only that buses have wheelchair lifts, but that bus drivers call out stops for passengers who are blind, and that the paratransit allow reliable next-day service. This is particularly critical because it ensures that the plaintiff in that case, who were teachers who were blind, have accessible transportation to their place of work, the Mississippi School for the Blind. And so we were very happy to be involved in that case, and the lawyers in that case worked remarkably heroically to forge that settlement. It is wonderful to be back among the career staff in the Civil Rights Division. I don't need to tell you, there were a lean 8 years from 01 to 09, but you know what? I'm not here to talk about that. I am here to pay tribute to the lawyers who stuck it out and are doing remarkable work. And we have been able to pick up the pace in so many different ways that I am just remarkably honored to be in this area. And one way in which we are picking up the pace in the disability rights context is to make sure that housing is accessible. As you know, the Fair Housing Act and the ADA have specific accessibility mandates, and yet far too many developers continue to forego their obligations, either knowingly or out of ignorance of the law, to make their developments compliant with the Fair Housing Act and the ADA. And I have a little bit of impatience, frankly, more than a little impatience, when people tell me, I didn't know about this. Well, it's only been around for 20 years. It's really hard to plead ignorance when you have something that's been around that long. But that's precisely what we had. We settled a case, and Mark, you'll appreciate this, most recently in Iowa and in Tennessee. In both cases, we insisted that the developers not only fix their non-compliant properties, but also pay compensation to the people with disabilities who sought to live in the developments, as well as civil money penalties to the United States. We've also embarked on a very extensive outreach program to educate developers and architects about their obligations. I personally spoke to a group of architects a couple months ago in Kansas City, and we will continue to emphasize both outreach, education, and enforcement in order to bring compliance in this area. In addition to housing, access to hospitals, as you know, is a critical need for all individuals and also individuals with disabilities. The landmark health reform bill signed last month by President Obama will ensure, and I am so thrilled about this, that so many people with pre-existing conditions will get the coverage to which they are entitled. But you know what? It's wonderful to have the coverage, but if you have a hospital that's inaccessible when you need the coverage is a little pyrrhic. And that is why we must work hand in hand to ensure accessibility in hospitals. This issue is a top priority, and we will soon be releasing guidance on the issue of accessible medical equipment. Needless to say, if you're doing the math here and keeping score at home, there are a lot of regulatory issues that we are working on as we speak. But it's important also to talk about the abysmal unemployment rate for people with disabilities. The Secretary of the Department of Disabilities in Maryland is a wonderful woman, Kathy Raggio. I believe her assistant is still here. One of her deputies I spoke to earlier today. She is a wonderful person who has really put remarkable focus on this issue in the state of Maryland. And she has educated me so much about this issue. And we must ensure that we continue to make efforts in this. And the agreement in Jackson is an agreement that will help people who are employed to remain employed. And it's so critically important. And if you want to be employed, you have to have the educational foundation. And so we will continue to work to ensure that children with disabilities not only have access to the free education, but it is the appropriate education to meet their needs as required by the IDEA. And we will work to ensure that they are not shut out of private schools and facilities. We're currently working on a case against the Nobel Learning Communities, which runs more than 180 daycare facilities, preschools, and elementary schools in 15 states, but refuses to admit children with developmental disabilities and disenrolls children who are found to be in the autism spectrum. We will fight that case hard, and we will continue to work to ensure that those children with disabilities have the opportunity to get the educational foundation that is truly the great equalizer in America. So, I mean, we got a long list of things going on here, and I've only just begun, but we're continuing to work hard on so many different cases. But we also have to work equally hard on the continuing and ongoing process of altering attitudes, because attitudes have altered on a very real level, but many attitudes need to continue to evolve. That's a job for us. That's a job for you. That's a job for everyone in this room and then some. And that is why it's so important for us to make sure that we continue to educate people, to show through our actions, through our hiring processes, through our hiring decisions, that we respect the basic value that we're going to judge people by the content of their character and not any other irrelevant characteristic. We've also been involved in a lot of other cases because people have asked me recently, why do we need a civil rights division? I swear to God, I thought they were joking. I was asked that the first day on the job. I've been asked that on talk show hosts. We're in this post-racial America thing, we're told. And, you know, my reaction to them is, come spend a day in the life of the Civil Rights Division, or a week in the life of the Civil Rights Division. Let's talk about the kid, the parents who tried to go to an RV park. They had adopted a child who was HIV positive. And the father was getting treatment for a very serious ailment, and they got enough money up to go to an RV park. And when the RV park in Alabama found out that their son was HIV positive, they told him to pound sand and get out of there. That's America in the year 2009. These are the cases that are coming across the transom. I've said many times, I wish I were the Maytag repairman. Remember that commercial? You know, the guy just sitting around waiting for the phone to ring? Well, I'll tell you, my friends, I'm actually the Toyota mechanic. I mean, you know, when these are real cases, and when we have to fight for a deaf social worker's right to be hired doing a job that she's eminently qualified for because the government employer doesn't want to accommodate her with a part-time interpreter. We had that case in California. So we're constantly reminded that we've made a lot of progress, but we've got a long way to go. We had a case against an attorney in Colorado who wouldn't, and Mazin, tell Sebastian to close his ears, he refused to allow a woman with a service dog into his office. This is a real case involving a lawyer who refused. I can't make this stuff up, okay? I really can't. These are the cases that we're dealing with. I mean, two cases in North Carolina involving the issue of allowing individuals who have been placed in community settings to stay there. Because one of the challenges we're confronting in tough budget times is that states are using budget woes to reinstitutionalize people. Well, our statement is just the opposite. If you want to be cost effective, move people into communities because the dollars are very clear. It's much cheaper than the $260,000 per year annual cost per resident that is currently in place in the one state institution in Alabama. That's a lot of money, even by Bob Dole standards. And so we need to recognize that we continue to have these challenges, and we will continue, regardless of the face of the issue, to be that voice for people who are living in the shadows. That's why I love this job. We have a president who cares deeply about civil rights. It was the only sub-cabinet agency mentioned in the State of the Union. I would clap for this president. We have an attorney general who's called our division the crown jewel of the Department of Justice. We are indeed the conscience of the department, the conscience of the nation in a very real regard. And we will continue through our enforcement of a wide panoply of laws to give meaning to the notion of equal justice and equal opportunity. We should embrace the challenge. And I love reading the words of so many people who have come before us, but Professor Tenbrook, who wrote that we embrace that challenge and embrace the concept that he promoted, that the policy of the law should be by negative ban and positive fostering to permit, enable, and encourage men and women to be a part of their communities to the full extent of their physical capacities. That is what our work is all about. This is not simply a legal imperative. It's an economic imperative. It's a moral imperative. It's an obligation that we embrace, and it is a job that we will continue to do as long as necessary. So thanks for having me. Thank you for your advocacy, and thank you for your leadership. Thank you, Mark.
I don't think there's time for questions.
5 minutes.
5 minutes?
5 minutes. Thank you.
Splendid talk.
Thank you.
You're not running for office, are you?
No.
Now, Assistant Attorney General Perez says that he has 5 minutes for questions, although he's supposed to be back in Washington at 2 o'clock. He does have 5 minutes, he says. So if you have a question, shout it out.
Uh-oh.
Andy.
Yes, Andy, what can I do for you? Well, the decision talks about treatment professionals, and one of the things we're finding is that there hasn't even been any sort of analysis done. So the basic framework that's been set out in the opinion hasn't been followed, and so we look to that opinion for that guidance. And I certainly agree that, and we many of the cases that we're dealing with, we're not the state is not contesting the contention on our part that a substantial subset of their institutionalized population can live in the community. They just haven't done it, and they haven't built the community capacity. And frankly, there's not the political will in a lot of states to do this. It's a forgotten population, and that saddens me. And that's our job, is to represent forgotten populations.
Mm-hmm. Particularly in this economic climate, but even if we were in a better climate. I'm just wondering if you've thought about what the department can do using Olmstead to try to push back on an effort on the part of the states to cut on the optional services.
I guess I would say stay tuned, because we have a few cases at work, and I think you're going to find, I'm hopeful that we're going to find some good templates, and then we're going to export those templates elsewhere.
I noticed that Mazen Bazrawi is a blind lawyer, and I understand that the department is contemplating assisting with recognition of disability capacity by employing people who have other disabilities, and I congratulate you and commend you for that.
Well, thank you. It's a simple outgrowth of my philosophy. You hire the most qualified people. Plain and simple. Yes, sir.
How many people with disabilities are employed by you, are in your department?
I don't know the answer to that question. I can only talk about, in the front office, we have about 15 staff. Mazen, you've met, is a person with disability in the front office. Department-wide, I don't know the data, but I will say the following. It's not enough. And I have met with people in our Office of Justice Management who they're the personnel folks. I've met with affinity groups who are working on this issue. I've met with the Attorney General himself more than once to talk about this issue because he has a host of concerns. He wants to build a workforce that is a model workforce that is the most qualified people that reflects the diversity of the communities we're trying to serve. And we are embarking on a number of very aggressive steps to reach that end. But the short answer is not nearly enough. All right, there you go. USA Jobs. Great. Yeah, I apologize for having to run, but I do have a meeting with the Associate Attorney General. One more question over here. If you could give me your card, I will have our disability rights section and our housing section have a very robust program of outreach. But my philosophy is you can never do enough outreach, and it's evidenced by the fact that we continue to have people who say, I didn't know that 20 years after the fact. And so I'd love to get your card and put somebody in touch with you. Thank you again for your time, and thank you for your leadership. Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Attorney General Perez. It has been great to have you come to this law symposium, and you have certainly given us food for thought and a lot of excitement about the prospects in the years to come. As we find things that need attention, we'll let you know. Thank you so much. Enjoy your cake, and we'll see you in the meetings this afternoon.